I will if you have a fat DeLorean waiting for me the next time I get here. So
always, mate. Yeah. As soon as I finished it, you can have the first one.
Yeah, there you go. I like
it. Hello and welcome to episode 216 of the Rockstar CMO Effing Marketing Podcast. It's Saturday, the 4th of May. I hope you've had a good week and you're staying as sane as you feel you need to be. I'm your host, Ian Truscott. I'm not a rock star, but I'm a CMO and I'm a trusted advisor. And on this podcast, with the help of my chums, we share marketing street knowledge to inspire your inner rock star. Come say hello. You can find links to me and my guests in the show notes at rockstarcmo.com or on LinkedIn at rockstarcmo. And we are proud members of the Marketing Podcast Network. My normal studio sidekick, Jeff, is away for another week, so it's just me solo in the studio sharing five thoughts for the week. And in the Rockstar CMO virtual bar, Robert Rose shares a thought over a very fine sounding cocktail. But first, we need to pay the bar tab. I'll be back in a moment.
We'll be right back.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcasts.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Well, let's get this show started with five thoughts from me inspired by my week. Five effing thoughts from me this week. It's probably the last time in a while as Jeff is back next week, but I'm curious to know what you thought of this experience. Maybe I'll continue with a shorter version of this. As ever, I'm keen to hear your thoughts. Anyway, my first thought. I'm starting with a thought about competitors and specifically who they are. Last week, I talked about the importance of having competitors. It demonstrates a market, and often your competitors have probably done the hard work in establishing the category and marketing the problem you're trying to solve. So competitors are important and we should embrace them. And if you think about an industry event, you know, these are often seen as a honeypot of opportunities for vendors. And you need other vendors to support the existence of an industry event. Can you imagine an industry event with just one vendor? It wouldn't be an industry event anymore. So we need that kind of community of competitors in order to kind of have a market that we can play into. But then what are those other competitors, aside from the traditional ones that do the same thing as you, but slightly differently, and obviously aren't as leading or as innovative as you are? Well, the other competitors we need to think about, perhaps, are like Do Nothing. And this is probably the most popular competitor that we probably face as B2B marketers. You know, the thing they're doing today is just good enough. They don't need to change. And I think I talk a lot about in B2B marketing that a lot of our job is actually to inspire change. Why would they consider our product, our services, or whatever it is that we're shilling is because they would, and for them to adopt it, they're going to need to change. So have a think about what is it they're doing today, what tools and processes, what change in the world actually could make them continuing like that be untenable. So what is it you could introduce them that says doing it like that tomorrow is not going to work? You need to think about this differently. You need change. You need to think about our product. The other big competitor, I think, for us, and it's like a relation of Do Nothing, is the fear of fucking up. So people are galvanized not to make a decision. So they're worried about making a decision and they don't want to screw up that decision. So they continue to kick the decision down the road and they continue to do nothing, because they have this fear. And I've talked about this quite a bit, probably on my blog more than on this podcast, is the idea that actually B2B buying is quite emotional, and that and we need to think about that with our personas. What risk are they putting into making a decision to choose our product? And how can we help de-risk that decision? What can we show them that will say to them, this is going to work. This is going to be okay. You don't need to fear fucking up, right? Which is our big competitor there. The other competitor that I think a lot of people put a lot of effort into talking about, aside from, you know, our traditional competitors and the idea the buyer might not do anything, is this competition for attention. So I saw a funny video on LinkedIn the other day that I think probably came from TikTok about somebody parodying a B2B marketer, where, you know, their content versus, you know, something exciting happening over on TikTok. So are we competing for attention with funny TikTok videos with our content? And I don't necessarily think that's true. And also, you know, you've probably heard me talk about the bollocks of the sort of goldfish idea that we've got a limited attention span. Yes, competition for attention is much keener than it used to be, but I still think people will make the time for that. But it's something we need to consider when we're looking at our competitors. So not just our competitors that we need, those that are in our market, not just the competitor of do nothing, make sure that they move forward and they don't fear fucking up, but also how do we grab their attention? What is it that we need to put into our content that sort of invites us into that conversation? I think I talked about, a bit about that last week as well. So speaking of TikTok, my second thought is a quick thought on rented land. And of course, there are content creators that are currently nervous about TikTok being banned, but I'm not really going to talk about that. You can hear about that in lots of other podcasts. But a little glitch in my podcast this week suggests that maybe we need to rethink how we apply the term rented. See, what happened last week, there was a little bit of a glitch in the matrix that was beyond my control that meant that Apple Podcasts didn't pick up this podcast for quite a few hours. And it took a while for me to fix it and see what had happened and realize that Apple hadn't picked up my podcast. And you can manually go in and there's things you can do and it doesn't really matter right now. But clearly there had been a disconnect between the podcast hosts and the syndication and Apple Podcasts. Now, most of you actually listen to this podcast on Apple Podcasts. So it was a big bit of a dip in the audience. And you've probably heard people like Joe Polizzi, who's a bit of a fan of, that I kind of share some of his work when I'm talking, when I do this or when I do my blog posts. And when he talks about, and obviously he works with Robert Rose, who you'll hear from in a moment in the bar. And you normally hear this term rented land applied to social media. And the fact that, you know, there could be a change in terms of service or an algorithm change, or like the TikTok example of it being banned, suddenly you've lost your whole audience. But this little example that I had last week suggests that maybe we need to think about how we define rented land. This Google Doc, for example, that I've written some notes on for this podcast that I'm reading from right now, is rented. I'm actually experimenting with Adobe Podcast to record this. That's rented. And then the platform that you're hearing this from and that I'm syndicating it through, as from the example of last Saturday and that little fuck up, basically, between the podcast host and Apple, suggests that all of that is rented. So everything is rented. And normally podcast is not normally considered rented land as it's direct because, you know, this is pretty much more in my control, I guess, than a social media algorithm. You can choose to listen to me and you have got choices. But sort of monopoly still sort of exists. For example, the fact that so many of you listen to this on Apple Podcasts gives them a level of control. Although I actually did see a little spike in Spotify listeners last week. So obviously some people thought, hang on, where has it gone? Is it still exist? Oh, yes, I found it. It's on Spotify. But that obviously could be a coincidence. But Apple sort of own my connection with you. I'm not sure where I'm going with this in terms of conclusion, because normally, you know, the conclusion with these things, with dealing with a monopoly, that sort of the content marketing folks will tell you about rented land, is you need to diversify. You know, if this podcast or creating TikTok videos were my main business, I'd need to consider broadening that media portfolio. And of course, the only thing you really own is your email list. And then if you take this argument even further, obviously you don't, because you've got it on a platform that you're renting, right? So whether that's MailChimp or HubSpot or whatever it is, or Beehive as I use, you know, you're still renting that space. So maybe we just need to chill out a bit on this rented land term. We all have to rent. but make sure we have multiple properties. So that's a little thought there about rented land. And speaking of email, my third thought is about cold sales emails, and particularly one I received this week. I shared it in my Tuesday 2 Cents column and it resonated with my LinkedIn network, so I thought I'd share it here. I'm working with a client and they plan on attending an exhibition. So I've emailed the organisers and I'm using a brand new email address for this client. And it seems the organisers have decided that sharing my name and my shiny new email address with a list of marketing vendors is fair game. Sure, it's fine. Maybe having a quieter inbox, a new client, or the fact that I actually need to understand this new category that I'm working in has me opening up more of these sales emails than I normally would. But reading through a few of them, I started to think, what do they want me to do? Here's an example of one of those emails. It started by saying, and it started quite strong, "Hi, Ian. The introvert in the corner at a party often fades into obscurity, and in a world saturated with content and fierce competition, simply pushing messaging won't cut it." Or simply pushing messages won't cut it. That sounds like poetry to me. I'd like to nick that, especially as I'm a bit of an introvert. That sounds great. Or maybe actually I'm a shy extrovert, but that's a conversation for another day. The email continues referring to the event that we are attending, which kind of triggered this whole, them cold calling me, I guess. "The event is your opportunity to truly stand out and leave a lasting impression, and our company are here to offer you our expertise. Our team of 140 experts is dedicated to providing you with the tools you need to maximize your experience, all at a fraction of our usual rates. Click on the link below, have a review, and we would be more than happy to jump on a call to discuss further." They tell me the opportunity, right, so I can truly stand out, and they conclude by offering me something, some services, for cheap, right, at a fraction of their normal rate. But what is it? What tools do I need to maximize my experience at an event? I've been to lots of events. I don't recall needing tools to maximize my experience beyond knowing which coffee stand has the shortest queue and the best spot to get a seat for lunch. Okay, and also maybe convincing the salespeople to get off the phones and just put the fucking leads into the CRM. But I've digressed. What problem will they actually solve for me? This email doesn't tell me that. And think of the plight of the modern email. It's like an Indiana Jones movie. It's entering the Temple of Doom, the torturous journey of being planned, sent, and ducking the blows of Apple, Google, and Outlook trying to punt you into junk, unimportant or not focused on. And then finally, that moment when it survives, and after all of that, it gets opened and read. It has its moment to shine, and it's offering to maximize your experience at a fraction of our usual rates. It's a shame, isn't it, for this poor email. Maybe we've all been there. We've all been in the meeting where the goal is to do a thing, send an email campaign, attend an event, have a tick face strategy or some random act of marketing. And as I've shared often, when managing a marketing team, we need to ask why. We need to ask it often. This marketer's goal was not to send the email, but to get me to do something. And I think if you can articulate why you are doing something internally during a campaign's planning phase, we're better able to make that ask during the execution. I use the phrase "make that ask" because I've heard a few times recently that one of the differences between good and bad salespeople is the ability to ask for business. So back to this kind of cold email, ask yourself why. Why does the recipient care? And in this case, me, because you can help them with a need or pain. What is that need or pain and how can you do that? And why should the recipient act? Because you showed me how to get that help and you asked me to do it. I mean, what's the worst that can happen? An email doesn't get opened. It doesn't get clicked through. It just happened. And then for the love of God, quit. Don't follow up with all the passive aggressive shit that clutters our inboxes. I just had an internal salesperson email me telling me how disappointed he is in me. To use a fishing analogy, you've cast your bait, just cast again, try somebody else. I'm not sure if this is a great segue into my fourth thought, but that's my thinking at the moment about these cold emails. But I mentioned planning there, and I want to touch on something that I've been digging into as I've wanted to include this in my book that you may have heard I'm trying to write. And it's triggered by some things I'm reading on LinkedIn, and I'm a bit concerned about it. It's what's being described as a diversity bonus, in that it doesn't matter what background, gender, level of education, political bias, age, or ethnicity you are, you look around your team and see only people like you, you're probably missing an opportunity to improve your team's performance, specifically around creativity. I'm digging into some studies that point to this, pretty keen on this topic. For example, in their publication, Insights by Stanford Business, from the Stanford Business Graduate School of Business, Professor Adina Sterling, an organizational theorist and economic sociologist, she might be a socialist as well, I don't know, states, when people from different backgrounds that have different ideas come together, research has shown is that they tend to outperform. From a creative and an innovative standpoint, groups that are outperform groups that are more homogeneous. Okay, I'm struggling there a bit with some of those words, but you get my point. She's saying that diverse teams outperform homogeneous teams from a creative point of view and from an innovative point of view. And it's tempting to think this diversity bonus is most beneficial for B2B businesses that serve an audience with high levels of diversity. So, for example, if you're selling into a market where the audience tends to be diverse, then your business should be diverse. And that we need to build teams that reflect our buyer and worry less if we serve traditional homogeneous industries. For example, I was chatting to an industry analyst who remarked about how many of the buyers in the category she covered were women and how many of the sellers were men. The vendors didn't reflect the market, which is a good observation. I think that's something worth thinking about. But these studies suggest to me that diversifying our creative thinking is beneficial for all of us, beyond just doing being the right thing to do, even if our company already reflects our audience. You know, the typical one, obviously, is, you know, you've got a bunch of men selling into a business that's a bunch of men. It's still going to be beneficial to have a diverse group in your marketing team because you'll have better ideas. And one of my chums, Keith Smith, explored this with some interviews on his Huel podcast last year. I'll include a link to some of those ideas in the show notes and some of his episodes. Specifically, he looked at how education plays a role here. Not all creative kids and potentially great marketers can go to university or do unpaid internships. So there's a big sort of topic around education that I'm not going to dive into here. It's a big topic. And that was just a quick thought. Take a look around your team. Is everyone the same? And it's not just gender and race, but economic background, education, and the experience they had getting to that position. Like I say, diversity isn't just the right thing to do. You just could be missing out. So for my final thought, something a little lighter, but in the ballpark of shaping our organizations. You might have seen on LinkedIn a relatively new feature called collaborative articles, which seem to be spawned by AI. And some of them are absolute shit, to be honest. And I'm guessing they're being used by LinkedIn to help train the AI. But I've been drawn in as they've gamified it, offering badges for top contributors. Who doesn't love a badge? Anyway, chipping in on one article, I came across a contribution from another marketer. They included a piece of advice she had been given by their boss. If you can help me grow, I can help you grow, which they'd appreciated. They said this advice had been useful in managing upwards later in their career as understanding their relationship with their manager. But I wasn't sure how I felt about that. Should it be a contract? Shouldn't a boss be helping one of their subordinates grow unconditionally by default? Should it be framed in this way as a quid pro quo contract? As marketers, we are usually employed to make other people more successful or a little richer. Whether it's the leadership team, investors or shareholders, we're obviously not the only ones in the organization doing this, but it's the job. We often recommend that we tie our marketing objectives with those of the leadership team and the business on this podcast and in our work. And of course, the more successful we can be as marketers in driving the business forward, the better things get for us. The word gets out and the world gets a bit more fun, and we can work with a bigger team, fun agencies, and we can indeed grow as marketing professionals. So the statement is absolutely true. If you can help me grow, I can help you grow. But should a boss be saying that to the team? Those are my thoughts for this week. And as is customary on this show, we have a 30-second musical interlude. And here is my track for this week. It's Georgia Smith, Be Honest, featuring Burner Boy from 2019. Partly because I just really like this track and I've had it on repeat on Spotify this week. But also, it's a common thread through these thoughts. Be honest.
I know you want me. Every day, not only when you're lonely, yeah. You see, you think you know me, but you don't even know nothing about me, yeah. You see my thick thighs, lost when you look into my brown eyes. You see my little ways commit you switch sides. You never know the devil in a disguise. So why don't you stand up, baby, and tell me, tell me, tell me. So let me show you, show you, show you. I don't need to back it up. Don't wanna hold you, mold you, soul. Just split you in half with my heart. I just wanna love on you, trust in you, honor you. Please do the same on your part.
Little snippet of Georgia Smith, Be Honest, there from 2019. And next week, as I mentioned, Jeff is back and we're currently batting back and forth some topics to discuss. So if you have some ideas or thoughts that have caught your attention this week, why don't you let us know? Right, it's been a long week. Time for a cocktail and a marketing thought with Robert Rose, the Chief Troublemaker at the Content Advisory, as we join him in the Rockstar CMO virtual bar. Good evening, Robert. What are you drinking?
Oh, hello. Wow, what is going on in here? You've got a factory going on in here. I mean, you've got full metal presses, you've got hydraulic presses, you've got a conveyor belt going on. What is it that you're manufacturing here? It looks like a whole... Looks like you've completely turned this place into a manufacturing. I mean...
Yeah, it's Fat DeLoreans. It was an idea that I heard. Yeah, it was an idea I heard last week. And I thought, well, it's time that somebody started making Fat DeLoreans.
You'll start making the Cybertruck, the Rockstar CMO version of the Cybertruck. I like it. I like it. I like it. Yeah, it's loud. It's loud, but... But, you know, as it should be, I guess, for manufacturing automobiles, but EVs, right? You're in the EV business these days, so.
I am.
Yeah.
All right, so if we move away from this stigma making all this noise, and maybe make ourselves a cocktail.
Are you suggesting we should segue out of something? Okay, fine. We'll segue out. Yes, we will segue out. We have a lovely cocktail.
Okay.
We have a lovely cocktail for this week. This is a fancier cocktail, and it is another, last week we featured the Cadillac Margarita, but this week we'll feature another tequila drink, and it's called the Petronio, this is again, on the fancier side, so you probably don't have this in your desktop bar, and it comes out of Cartagena, Colombia, this cocktail. So it starts with tequila, 1.5 parts. Like a normal tequila cocktail would. A reposado for sure. You don't want to go añejo here. You want to go with a reposado, which is sort of in the middle of heaviness, as it were. Great for cocktails, tequila cocktails. Then you want to go with a half part of vanilla liqueur. Any of your vanilla liqueurs will do. You want to go with a little bit of lemon juice, maybe half ounce of lemon juice, half ounce of orange juice, both freshly squeezed if you can get it. And then... a one part of lulo puree, fruit. It's kind of a fruit puree there. And that, you mix all that together into a cocktail shaker filled with ice. You pull that over and over the ice in your cocktail glass and chill it if you want to, but, you know, or just, you know, start drinking and garnish maybe with an orange wheel or something like that on the top. And it will froth up. It'll be a nice little frothy drink. And it is an absolutely refreshing, wonderful cocktail. Very sweet and lovely.
Nice. Where did you come across this one? Because it's got two ingredients that, I mean, I'm not familiar with vanilla liqueur. And as for lulo puree, I've no idea what that is. So how did you discover this particular one?
This one was recommended to me by a friend. Nice. And then I went and actually looked up the recipe.
Yes.
And tried it, and it was actually quite good. You can actually get lulo puree. Lulo is a fruit, right? It's commonly used in smoothies and or desserts and stuff like that. If you just Google lulo puree, you can probably find it. I mean, certainly it's on Amazon or anything like that. So it's not as hard to find as you think it might be. Anyway, you can find it pretty easily.
Cool. I'd never heard of it. So, the very nice sophisticated drinks again this week. Whereabouts are we drinking these this week?
We would drink these, somewhere. I think we need to get out to the water. Mm-hmm. So let's find a beach somewhere. Maybe somewhere. Oh, on the Gulf. Maybe you know where we'll go is we'll go down to Joe Polizzi. My friend just got back from the Florida Keys.
Oh, I love it down there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. It could be argued that I had my honeymoon there because we got married and moved to the US 100 years ago. And our first holiday memory in the US was to go down to Miami and then go down to the Keys. So technically it's our honeymoon. And so it's had many fond memories down in that part of the world. So lovely. And it is the best part of Florida, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's really the only good part of Florida. Yeah.
So we had a bit of a rant last week, so should we do Florida this week?
Yeah, that's right.
So, but in truth, we're sipping these drinks in on the Keys. What when conversation turns to marketing, what are we talking about this week, mate?
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about social media. Because honestly, we haven't talked about social media a lot in a long time. And it's interesting because, you know, that it's still a thing and we still need to deal with it. And we just recently did some thinking on this and put some research together and all of that. And there's a lot going on in social media, but it feels like a lot of we were getting a lot of questions from clients about like, well, what the heck should we be doing with social media now, right? Yeah. What, you know, is it, where is, you know, where does it stand with Twitter and X and what do we do with Facebook and what's going on with TikTok and the ban and all that kind of stuff? So it felt like a good time to start thinking about it. And the interesting thing from a marketing perspective is that there's a very subtle but important shift that is providing an opportunity. And what I mean by that is that when you look at all the research, and we've got it all on our website, if you want to go look at all the different research, we just did this webinar on it. But basically, the research says two things are happening. It is growing, but it's a different kind of growth. In other words, what we see is passive versus active consumption, meaning that as users of social media, as consumers of social media, we as consumers, our audiences, they're not sharing as much anymore. They're not clicking as much anymore. News, clicking on news articles on social media is down exponentially across most all platforms. Sharing is down, and posting is down. And what that means, however, is that consumption of content is up. So if you think about that sort of balance of content creators on social media versus content consumers, you know, this isn't the right percentage, but basically you can think of it like this. If it was 80-20 before, right, you know, where 80% of us are consuming content and 20% are posting content, well, that's probably more like 95-5 now or 90-10, right? So it's come down quite a bit. And so the shift, however, gives some kind of interesting opportunities, which is one, as brands, we're no longer competing with people posting pictures of their breakfast anymore like we used to in 2015, 2016, 2017. So we are really competing with engagement of audiences, and we're competing with other brands against trying to engage those same audiences. So in other words, there is now, which maybe wasn't, you know, we used to bitch that, you know, organic reach was down to zero and all those kinds of things. And we had to use paid media and social to be able to get any sort of attention. Well, that our organic opportunity is now starting to re-emerge because the competition is lower in terms of the content. However, the content itself has also changed. So, for example, for those brands that are simply using their social media feeds as a glorified press, you know, feed, in other words, every article they produce to their blog, they just post to social media dutifully and blah, blah, blah. They're not seeing much action at all. Those that are actually focusing on creating holistic, engaging content in the actual channel itself and specific to the channel itself are finding much greater opportunities for engaging those audiences. And that's the real shift in the content strategy for what we're seeing in social media. And the other aspect of that is, you know, what we would call maybe ephemerality. In other words, creating digital scarcity, like eventizing your content on social media as much as possible. So making it the kind of thing where if you don't take action on this now, you're going to miss it. like, you know, mm-hmm. whether it's a registration for one of your webinar programs, or whether it's a event, or whether it's a video that disappears, or those kinds of things. We're starting to see that really become the focus. And so it gives us really a renewed focus on social media as a platform to engage our audiences, and a much bigger decrease in looking at social media as a place to, quote unquote, create community. In other words, creating your community there, if all you're doing with your Facebook page or your LinkedIn group or whatever is basically servicing people who are bitching and moaning about your product, probably not a great solution for you. Yeah. However, using it to actually engage and use as a broadcast media, paid or otherwise, is probably a good strategy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting, because what I was wondering as you were talking there, so engagement is up, but only if we play within their walled garden, because people aren't clicking through and engaging with the rest of our content. So that's where people are saying that organic social isn't working anymore, isn't it? It's not working because it's not driving people towards their properties. It's keeping people within the walled garden, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, look, organic reach is still tough, right? I mean, let's just be honest. I mean, it's still very hard, and the algorithm works against us and all those kinds of things. So paid plays an incredibly important role. So does shoppable, by the way. So shoppable is the other category that is really up, especially on things like Instagram and Facebook if you're in B2C. But if you're in B2B, for example, having great content on LinkedIn is incredibly important. However, now what we're seeing is that people matter more. So it's looking at your employees as content creators and influencers to try and create that sort of wave of great content going out on a social media platform, rather than sort of centralizing it only on your brand and using your brand to then do things like promote, like paid promotion of posts and paid promotion of other things, and elevate the people, but also elevate brands and stuff.
Right. Because I was going to ask you also about the algorithm, because one of the things on LinkedIn that I've heard a lot, and it's very hard, I've tried experiments to see whether it's true or not, but is that actually the algorithm, particularly on LinkedIn, is punishing people for having links in their content. And I think whether that's true or not, people are believing in it, aren't they? And they're less inclined to put links in their content, so therefore they're fueling that, aren't they? That there will be fewer links out. I mean, you know,
I think anybody who's, you know, so the one thing that I've learned from those who really understand social media, is that if you're trying to figure out if you think you've got the algorithm figured out, you're wrong. because here's the thing. What people don't realize is that one, the algorithm changes back and forth all the time. Mm-hmm. So companies are changing their algorithm. Two, the algorithm changes differently for different user sets, different segments of populations. So for example, you may, as a person, get a long form post with a link in it may perform amazingly well for you because you're not part of the algorithm. You're not part of the algorithm that deprecates such things, because they're testing, they're working all the time to roll out new versions. So you don't know, basically. Mm-hmm. So the only way to really think about that is to say to yourself, what's the most valuable thing I can do? Now, I tend to, for example, put anytime I'm doing a longer form post where I want somebody to take an action, like register or do something like that, or go off to an article, I tend to put it in the first comment only because then I can put an image in, a different kind of image in, you know, because it's, you know, for example, with LinkedIn, you can't put an image and a link in, right? Yep. So that are separate from each other, right? You can put a link in that uses the image of the actual page or featured image or whatever it is. Yeah. But then I can put whatever image I want in there, and I can put the link in the first comment. Mm-hmm. And I know then that I'm going to get, you know, people that are truly reading the post and then going to the first comment and doing that, right? So I'm actually building in a bit of friction purposely for that. Right. That's my by design, not necessarily because I'm trying to game the algorithm. Although if that helps, I don't know. It doesn't matter. I don't even think about it that way. But What we do know is that longer form, more valuable content is resonating better for most of the platforms, right? Especially that which allows you to do such, you know, not necessarily Threads or Instagram, but the, you know, Facebook and LinkedIn, they tend to reward valuable content that's contained within their ecosystem. And that just makes sense if you think about it. And that, you know, keeps people in the ecosystem. So content that gets a lot of comments right away, content that, you know, that tends to get a lot of, you know, views, and then that views tend to go up and all those kinds of things. So, you know, there are hashtag things to do in there and all those kinds of things to do. But I think if you just focus on high quality engagement, you're going to be fine.
It's interesting because I was going to ask you about your strategy with the links in the comments, because I noticed that you do that, and I just wondered about that on the basis. So it was good to hear your explanation of that, which makes a lot of sense. It's not just gaming the algorithm. It's just that LinkedIn doesn't allow you to do what you need it to do. And also adding that extra level of friction, kind of, you know, are you committed to clicking through to this thing or not, right? So
that's the primary reason. Reason for me, right? Like because then what I'm getting is people who have read the post and then went, oh, great, that's in the first comment, and I'll go click through. I know the people who are clicking through are, you know, are interested, right? Instead of just accidentally clicking on something to go, I can't read the post, I'm going to go read it on whatever it is, right? And that there's nothing to click there. You know, I'm going to be totally transparent. And if I get a little bit of better organic reach because of it, great. But that's not why I'm doing it.
No, it's good. And I know that you did a lot of research into this. And I don't know about you, but I saw a really good webinar on this the other day. Do you any idea where I might find something like that?
Well, that, yes, the webinar with all of our research, with the slides and a couple of good guides are available on our website, which is contentadvisory.net. And you'll see it in our featured, you'll see it featured on our website in our newest thoughts.
Splendid. I shall share a link to that, obviously, in the show notes.
Lovely.
And when people spin the dial on the interwebs, where are they going to find you, my friend?
They are going to find me on LinkedIn, on social media. And that's pretty much it. Although I am having some fun on Threads as well. Although I'm not posting there nearly as often as I thought I might.
No, I agree. I'm having trouble getting Threads into my routine. I've got LinkedIn in my routine. I'm having a bit of trouble with Threads, but yes.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah, it was an excellent webinar. And so you'll be posting links to the comments, links in the comments on LinkedIn. And more importantly to me, mate, and very easy to measure, is will you be in the bar next week?
I will if you have a fat DeLorean waiting for me the next time I get here. So
always, mate. As soon as I finished it, you can have the first one.
Yeah, there you go. I like it.
The Rockstar CMO fat DeLorean coming off the line now. All right, mate. I'll see you then.
Cheers. Cheers.
Thank you, Robert. I don't know about you, but I've been watching the coverage of the Miami Grand Prix, and I could use a bit of Florida Keys right now and one of Robert's splendid cocktails. So that's a wrap on episode 216 of the Rockstar CMO Effing Marketing Podcast. I've been your host, Ian Truscott. You can find links to me, Robert, and all the things we've discussed in the show notes on rockstarcmo.com, along with our blog, newsletter, and all of our previous episodes. And thank you for dropping a dime into your podcasting jukebox, selecting our track and jiving along with us. I'd love to hear from you, so please say hello or drop us a rating or review in your favourite podcast app, or just keep listening. I'm glad you're here. Next week, Jeff is back and we might be chatting about frontline marketing, but we haven't decided yet. And Robert will be back in the virtual bar with his weekly marketing thought. Until then, have a great week. And I hope you again join us here next week on Rockstar CMO FM.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.